Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley. This is the show that brings you conversations that matter every week from Premier Christian Radio and via podcast as well. So wherever you are, however you're listening, thank you for choosing Unbelievable. And I've such an interesting debate for you today. By the end of today's show, your brain may be aching. Towards the end of the programme, though, I'm going to give you more details on an interesting interview I had with Justin Welby recently, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Look out for that. And also details coming up as well about next week's exciting show, which will be broadcast live via our YouTube channel as well, as John Lennox and Peter Atkins meet at Southampton University. You can find out more about Unbelievable, past episodes, get hold of the podcast, lots of resources, the book, the DVD, and much more besides at our webpage, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Well, time to get into today's show. It's a deep dive into some pretty interesting philosophical waters as we discuss consciousness, logos, mind, and so on. One of those ones you might even want to, if you're listening via podcast, rewind and listen again, because there's a lot crammed in. And having a philosophical dictionary nearby might help as well. Let's meet today's guests. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the show, we're debating logos, God, our ability to make sense of the world. Some interesting subjects under discussion today. And I think it was Albert Einstein who said this or something like this: the most incomprehensible thing about the world is that it is comprehensible. And in his new book, Logos, The Mystery of How We Make Sense of the World, philosopher Raymond Tallis explores the various explanations for why we humans have a mind capable of understanding the universe it exists in. Raymond is himself an atheist. Today he's in conversation with US theologian and philosopher David Bentley Hart. Now, among David's books is The Experience of God, Being, Consciousness and Bliss, in which he argues that our experience of reality is ultimately grounded in God. I'm really looking forward to today's, I'm sure, philosophical conversation. I'll ask you both to try and keep it at as layperson friendly as you can in the course of the discussion. We'll come to you, David, in a moment's time. Looking forward to engaging with you again on today's show. Thanks for being on the line with us. But Raymond, your first time on the programme. Welcome along.
It is my maiden voyage, indeed.
Indeed. Yes. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Have you ever had any religious inclinations in your past?
Not strongly. I mean, I inherited a little bit of religion from school. My parents were not at all religious. My father was a Protestant, my mother was a Catholic, and I guess they decided to split the differences and become effectively atheists.
Okay.
And although my school was Church of England, or at least that was the professed religion, I don't think anybody took it particularly seriously. It was cultural rather than metaphysical. Mm-hmm. And certainly I didn't go through agony shedding the notion of God and separating myself from religion. So I've been a fairly relaxed about it secular humanist since I was a teenager.
Mm. But always interested, I suppose, in the metaphysical questions of life. And obviously, you've written a great deal in all kinds of different areas of philosophy. What led you to this particular one that you explore in this new book, Logos?
Well, I've always been puzzled by consciousness, totally reasonable to be so. A consciousness that's puzzled by itself is clearly onto something. I guess originally, as a teenager, I was quite scientistic. Mm. I certainly believed that ultimately the explanation of things would come from fundamental science. And it was my period as a training in medicine at Oxford, and in particular in neurophysiology, that I began to see that brain explanations didn't get anywhere near to consciousness. And I can remember I bored my infinitely patient tutor at Oxford, pointing out to him that basically a causal relationship between the outside world and a brain wouldn't generate somebody who was aware of an outside world. Mm. He was very patient. I didn't persuade him, but that is really was my entree to philosophy.
Right. I did a show last year, great programme, in which I was joined by Daniel Dennett and Keith Ward. On opposite ends of the spectrum, pretty much, on the issue of consciousness. Keith Ward, an idealist. Daniel Dennett, very much a materialist. And they just had a great discussion, but they just approached the thing from completely different ends of the spectrum. Do you have a label for where you fall in this this particular debate of consciousness?
Yes, I mean, I think I'm in a rather difficult position. I don't have a supernatural explanation of consciousness, but I very much resist naturalistic explanations of consciousness. Daniel Dennett has been one of my adversaries, although he's unaware of it, over many decades. I've always regarded his approach to consciousness very unsatisfactory. His book, Consciousness Explained, should be called Consciousness Avoided or Consciousness Evaded. So,
at this point, you sound like Keith Ward, but I doubt you go all the way with him either on the way he comes to terms with this.
I wouldn't, no. But certainly one thing I'm very aware of is that we do not yet have an understanding of where mind fits into the cosmos, the nature of consciousness, the relationship between mind and brain. And I'm very much with Jerry Fodor, who once said, you know, the mind-brain problem isn't just a little local difficulty. In order to address this, we're going to have to set aside most of our cherished conceptual framework.
Mm.
And I think that's the challenge for philosophy.
Okay. Give us a little intro to Logos. What are you attempting to do in a nutshell in this book?
I'm attempting to spell out my own amazement to some extent.
Mm.
I don't in the end explain how it is that we make sense of the world, but I try and make very clear the extraordinary nature of this project. I mean, one example I give is that we talk about the universe. We have the temerity to put the universe in inverted commas, having given it a name. But if you look at the size of our brains, 4 liters or so, against a universe that's 10 to the power of 23 cubic light years. It looks as if there's a slight asymmetry between the knower and the known, and that is rather extraordinary. So I think it is something that we need to become very aware of. How is it that we appear to have such extraordinary extensive knowledge?
Okay, we'll come to some of the explanations you deal with and dismiss in the book, I'm sure, in as we begin the conversation. But time to introduce our other guest today on the line, David Bentley Hart. Great to be joined by you again, David, from the USA. You've been sort of covering these issues for some time yourself. Do you want to give us a brief idea of why you particularly have been drawn to studying lately consciousness and this whole area that Raymond's also been interested in?
Well, I mean, for obvious reasons that Raymond's already laid out, that it is mystifying in its very nature. More, though, I think because it was initially part of a larger project I'd undertaken regarding what had happened at the threshold of modernity when an essentially mechanical model of nature had been adopted by natural philosophers, whom we would now call scientists. And then what happened thereafter when a model of nature having been produced that essentially had evacuated all the features of mind from nature, this model was then used or attempted to be used as a way of explaining consciousness itself, creating a curious impasse in which a method that was constructed precisely to view nature as if mind did not exist was then taken necessarily as providing the only means we would have of explaining why consciousness did exist.
Mm.
So that's a rather complicated way of saying that I was actually simply writing almost an intellectual history, or because the question of consciousness actually did not interest me as a metaphysical problem. I thought that before the modern period, the presuppositions of most philosophical systems were adequate to make sense of consciousness. But within the context of our modern picture of nature, we had rendered whatever coherence used to exist between our natural philosophy and our understanding of mind more or less, reduced it to ruins.
Hmm.
And then again, also, I'd devoted considerable years to the phenomenological tradition in continental thought. I'm not much of an aficionado of Anglo-American philosophy, except as that thing that I'm most anxious to ignore. I realized that the way we tend to talk about mind in the English-speaking philosophical world is as a kind of property or physical property almost, rather like mass or momentum, and that this made no sense when one actually looks at what consciousness is as an act. It's clearly not some sort of inert property that can be added to the physical picture of nature. It fundamentally challenges the picture of nature we're working with.
Yeah, so in a sense, I'm sensing that both of you, to some extent, on the same page in terms of naturalism and the, if you like, Daniel Dennett account of this, neither of you satisfied
with. Well, you see, Daniel Dennett is an old adversary of mine, and he does know it, though only fleetingly.
Let's see. Raymond, you wanted to respond to something, I think, that...
Just a quick point in terms of intellectual history, and I'm totally with David on this. It seems to me there was a crucial moment in early modern thought when Galileo basically separated primary and secondary qualities. And in the end, the primary qualities were those of size and number and so on. And they were real. They were, as it were, intrinsic properties of the universe that science was interested in. Secondary properties like warmth, colour, which are essentially qualities, these were not real. They were merely mental phenomena. So it was not at all surprising that eventually, as science progressed, it produced a picture of the world that was increasingly mindless. In fact, the ultimate picture of the world, quantum mechanics or general theory of relativity, is so mindless that it's just, quote, a system of magnitudes.
Do you feel like there is something of a response now going on in the philosophical and maybe even scientific community to that view, that mechanistic, if you like, view of reality? I know that, for instance, I've tried to get him on the show. He hasn't as yet said yes, but Thomas Nagel, in his view, in his book, I think, on mind and cosmos, is also similarly asking those kinds of questions about the naturalistic project and whether it can really account for consciousness and the, I suppose he might use the word logos as well, that we find in the universe, Raymond.
Most certainly. I mean, he was roundly criticized by many for Mind and Cosmos, which I think is a very brave book. But actually, in the recent years, it's become more and more fashionable to find mind way beyond our brains and human subjects. And panpsychism, which would have been regarded with horror by many analytical philosophers in the tradition that David doesn't like, panpsychism has started becoming almost respectable.
Right.
The question of which kind of panpsychism is coherent then is an interesting one, because at present, say in Britain, Galen Strawson's a good example. Yeah. They're philosophers who are eager to embrace panpsychism as a way out of the impasse created by the mechanical narrative, but want to do so still in terms of a materialism that will reduce consciousness to a kind of inherent physical property. And to me, this simply repeats the conceptual error of the past at a more basic level. It simply sort of reduces the question almost, well, to the subatomic level, in the hope that if it's made small enough, it might vanish away altogether. But the older notions that could be called panpsychists, those that are grounded not in the notion that consciousness is a property of matter, but rather that whatever matter is subsists in a reality that is like conscious thought, those also are enjoying revival among philosophers, even among certain scientists, and not just those who are au fait with quantum physics and in its various forms, but even you see this in taking place in molecular biology, or rather, I should say, biology, where things like systems biology are becoming more and more respectable as a kind of alternative to the purely mechanistic neo-Darwinian synthesis that you find in someone like Richard Dawkins.
Yes, I mean, the current panpsychism does have huge problems. The combination problem. If there's little
Precisely,
sequence
yeah,
of mind
exactly.
all over the world, then it's difficult to know why in some places, such as Raymond and David, mind gathers up into a subject with a viewpoint, and in other places, such as a pebble, it doesn't. And I think that's one of the great problems of panpsychism.
It doesn't.
My own feeling is it doesn't solve any problems. It just highlights
them in different
ways.
Well, I've never had any very good conversations with the pebble, but I don't want to presume anything.
let me see if we can, before we go on, just say that if you're listening and you would like to respond to anything you hear on today's show, do feel free to email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Other ways to get in touch and to listen back to today's show available from the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Do hope you can get in touch and enjoy today's discussion on the Logos, God, and making sense of the world.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
My guests on the show today are Raymond Tallis and David Bentley Hart. Raymond, I feel we should dig a little bit further into the book first and then hear what David has to say in response. Why for you is it a problem, this idea of why is it a mystery, the fact that we can know the world in which we exist? Because I can hear a Dawkins or a Dennett or anywhere else say, well, it's very simple, my dear fellow. We are evolved creatures, and to get on in life, it made sense that we would evolve faculties which would give us a good sense of who we are and what the world is like, and hey presto, you get advanced physics. So what's the problem for you with that particular account of the way we come to know our place in the universe?
There are very large numbers of problems. First of all, it doesn't make evolutionary sense for creatures to be conscious. Actually, the value of consciousness is, in evolutionary terms, is very unclear. If you were serious about survival, what you would be is a mechanism. Mechanisms are absolutely footsure because the laws of nature are by definition unbreakable. So self-replicating mechanisms would beat the pants off any conscious, hesitating, deliberating organism.
As in a sense bacteria do in the world today.
Exactly. If you want to look at a really successful organism, the thing to be is a bacterium. So there is really no clear advantage to consciousness, even less to knowledge. The kind of knowledge that we have, for example, that has produced GPS. If you were serious about finding a way in the wilderness, you wouldn't wait 600 years for the laws of mechanics to deliver something like GPS. You'd be dead a long time ago. So consciousness is A, useless, but the other is we have no notion of how out of the bloodbath between creatures, something called self-awareness would be secreted and produced. So, in a sense, consciousness sits very, very uneasily with evolutionary theory.
And you're not satisfied, presumably, though, with a sort of theistic explanation? I mean, when you do hear someone like, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of people like Keith Ward, but who would say that it seems to be consistent, the fact of consciousness, with the idea of an ultimate mind, you know, something that intended for there to be this synthesis between the knower and the known in that sense. What's your response to that kind of approach?
Before we get to a theistic explanation, it's perhaps a good idea to set aside an all totally opposite understanding it is we understand the world, which is, there's a wonderful quote from Plotinus. David probably knows Plotinus much better than I do, but he says, if the eye were not sun-like, how would it see the sun? So basically, the argument from the naturalist, which we just talked about, from the evolutionary psychologist, is we see the sun because we're a bit like the sun. The opposite view is we see the sun because the sun is like us. In other words, the sun is actually a quasi-mental phenomenon. And this brings us to Kant, the notion that the objects we perceive are, as it were, synthesized out of our experiences by the mind. So this puts the world inside the mind, and that makes it seem to be accessible for knowledge and understanding. That doesn't work either, by the way.
Is that kind of way of looking at things the idea that, well, we don't really perceive the world around us as it is, if you like. We rather have a helpful image of the, in our mind, of what the world is. I mean, does it posit that there is still a physical external world that's there to be known, or is it somehow all internal?
Yes. It's much more radical than that. The idea of a world around us, things set out in space and in time, are themselves the result of the synthetic activity of the mind. All that's left over when you remove, as it were, the synthetic activity of the mind is essentially the in itself, which doesn't have properties such as causation, being set out in space and so on and so forth, and essentially intelligible but indescribable.
Well, maybe we'll leave it for David to make the theistic case. Where do you come, though, between those two extremes?
Well, perhaps I could
your point
show my position, which essentially is that although I'm a secular humanist, I'm against an awful lot of humanists who think the alternative to a supernatural view of the world is a naturalistic view of the world. And I think supernaturalism and naturalism are equally incorrect. My position is one of profound agnosticism. I'm an ontological agnostic. I just don't know how the world is put together. I certainly don't know how it is that it is intelligible, how something as big as the world is intelligible as something as small as me. I have no idea. In the book, I explore some of the brilliant and very interesting ideas of theologians and philosophers, the notion of logos being central to one strand of philosophy, one of various strands of theology, and of course to Christian doctrine as well. But in a way, I don't think they present us with an answer.
I want to come back to, obviously, the intriguing use of the word logos, which of course is so central to John's gospel, among other things. But David, the way that Raymond has sketched out the different views that exist out there about the way we come to make sense of the world, do you broadly agree that those are the different camps? And where do you come from when it comes to your own perception of how this all links back to an ultimate grounding of this in God?
Right. Well, I don't know if I agree or disagree entirely, because we're using certain words like supernatural and God as if we've already agreed on what the content of those words is. And since you mentioned my book of, what was it, 5 years, 6 years ago now, the experience of God, much of the point of that book was simply to argue that we use these words with such vagueness that we often don't know that we're talking past one another. So it depends. I mean, say it's theistic view, what does that mean? Or supernaturalism, what does that mean? The term supernatural has a very specific and very limited history in Christian thought, for instance, and not one that I'm entirely satisfied with in its in certain of its later expressions. So let me just put it this way. I think that a rigorous, a scrupulous phenomenology of the act of consciousness itself discloses a very unsettling set of facts about it. One is, of course, that it is phenomenal in nature, as Raymond has mentioned. It takes in the world qualitatively. And at the beginning of the modern era, the sort of Galilean picture of nature, or with slight variances, the picture of nature you find in Bacon, although that's a contested area, was content simply to allow for a division of spheres, to say that the physical description of nature is one thing, and then there's another realm, that of soul or God, which is in a kind of extrinsic alliance with this otherwise mechanical reality of nature. But of course, reason abhors a dualism, and over time, the mechanical view tried to subsume the mental into itself. And as a result, when we talk about consciousness, we often reduce it to simply phenomenal awareness. The problem is that's not all that's going on. Where Kant, for instance, is oddly deficient is that he creates a very elaborate picture of the transcendental deduction, that is, what the structure of cognition is if we do not presume that we can get to reality in itself. But he doesn't actually give an adequate description of the act of consciousness or the act of conscious rational mind itself, which is irreducibly intentional and irreducibly unified in its field of apprehension. And the problem with this, then, it means that what the conscious mind does, if you're taking the mechanistic model seriously, is one that can't correspond to nature at all, because neither final causes, that is the purposes that intentionality presumes, nor non-composite unities of the sort that the experience of consciousness requires are possible within a mechanical picture. So instead, what we've got to presume is that if we take what the phenomenology of consciousness discloses seriously, some sort of magical communion between the two that we understand only under a regime of representation in the mind of the sort Kant describes, which is incredibly mysterious because that regime would seem to involve a translation of the experience of reality into a whole semiotic order, a whole order of relations that requires a faculty of translation. But translation requires some kind of mysterious knowledge, both of the thing being translated and the system into which it's being translated. So you have all these curious chasms. Well, Raymond mentioned Plotinus. There you have a picture, a pre-modern picture, that rather than presuming that mind is the emergent result of an incalculable array of physical causes, and causes here understood purely in the mechanical sense as exchanges of energy between physical objects in motion, it presumed instead that the world itself was, as he says, mind-like. But if that's so, what does that mean? Well, it involves intentionality, unity of consciousness. It involves a series of rational relations that include purpose among them. What's all this break down to? Well, I'm taking too long and I don't want to steal the time.
It's all right. It's a big subject and needs to be spelled out. So, but yeah, where does it land us in the end then?
Well, also this is that since it would take too many hours to make the argument here, I'll just jump to my conclusion, is that when we're talking about consciousness, I think if we look at what we do in our intentionality, for instance, our intentionality to be intelligible can't be just directed at specific objects. It's directed at specific objects within the embrace of a larger intentionality towards a horizon of let's call them transcendental values, true, good, beautiful, whatever. How we arrange our experience of reality that's functionally infinite and supernatural. I would use supernatural in that sense. And I think that any finite act of consciousness can only be understood ultimately as a participation in an infinite act of consciousness, that is, infinite mind knowing itself. And so, I go back to the same sort. I mean, Plotinus, for instance, would be a good place to start and a good place to end as far as I'm concerned. Certain Vedantic philosophers come to mind, certain Christian thinkers like Maximus the Confessor or Nicholas of Cusa are very good on these things.
Obviously, you've boiled a great, the whole of your thesis really into a soundbite, and I appreciate it's difficult to do that. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back to see what Raymond has to say in response to that. And I do want to get to this question of Logos itself and this principle, if you like, that's mentioned in the Christian Gospels, and that has obviously been used by other philosophers and traditions down the centuries. We're talking about Logos, God, and making sense of the world here on Unbelievable today. Raymond Tallis and David Bentley Hart are my guests.
After growing his Californian congregation from 30 members to 6,000, Francis Chan turned his back on the American megachurch model.
Look at churches. There are so many who exist that are not making disciples. People are not getting baptized, and yet they're spending a fortune. How is it then that the underground church in China grew to 100 million people?
Inspired by churches in Asia, the acclaimed preacher believes he's now promoting a more authentic expression of Christianity. Read the full interview with Francis Chan exclusively in this month's Premier Christianity magazine.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/free sample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's show. Albert Einstein said something like this. I'm pretty sure this isn't a direct quote, but the most incomprehensible thing about the world is that it is comprehensible. And in his new book, Logos, The Mystery of How We Make Sense of the World, philosopher Raymond Tallis gives various explanations and his own thoughts on why we humans have this extraordinary ability to make sense of the world. He's not satisfied with a lot of the naturalistic accounts that are given, even though he is himself an atheist. And we've heard David Bentley Hart in the first part of today's show, Raymond. giving a potted history, if you like, of how he comes to see that there is a sense in which a supernatural explanation, and he's obviously qualifies that as to what we mean by that, makes sense of the nature of consciousness and the way we experience the world. Feel free to give a summary of what David said and then your own response to it.
Yes, I'm sure I'm not doing what he says justice, but his notion, in a sense, that we have, the very fact we have any consciousness, it has to be explained by us being part of something much greater, almost as global, universal consciousness. And David, you'll correct me on that. But it seems to me that is a problem, precisely the problem that Kant has. Kant, as it were, explains our understanding of the world by the fact that the world, in some sense, is a product of our minds. He says the synthetic activity of the mind is the lawgiver of nature. Now, that's a great problem, because out of that we have no explanation of partial knowledge, of the fact you have one viewpoint, I have another. That can only be explained by embodiment, by the fact that there is something fundamental or primary about our bodies. But unfortunately for Kant, bodies are set out in space and endure in time. So in other words, we have to presuppose space and time, or a location in space and time, in order for us to have viewpoints and so on. But he tries to, as it were, include space and time and so on within viewpoints. And that seems to me a similar sort of problem, David, unless I've misunderstood you profoundly, with your notion that any consciousness, as it were, implies some kind of access to or being part of a universal greater consciousness, that our little logos, if you like, must therefore be part of the greater logos, the universe. And I'm sure I've totally misunderstood what you said, and now you'll correct me, and then I'll come back.
Okay, David, do you want to correct Raymond? Has he misunderstood?
Oh, it would take so long. It is a misunderstanding, but it's entirely my fault. It's the problem of trying to summarize too much in too small a time. The Kantian analogy is deeply offensive, and I suspect we'll have to duel this out
somewhere. My intention
misty
was
morning
only,
in a park.
Only to give him offense,
But no, the issue of individual perspective, to my mind, is itself not a problem. The question of how we come to have a field of knowledge of finite and particular things within a fixed perspective simply raises the larger question of how it is we know finite particular things at all. My claim is, and here I'm drawing somewhat on Bernard Lonergan, but as filtered through a more romantical kind of Neoplatonism, that this requires an original and inextinguishable and inexhaustible preoccupation of consciousness with a transcendental horizon. That is, we know things within a field of interpretation laid out for us by our prior transcendental desire for, say, the true. Now, how is this so? That's not an issue of the correspondence between a world out there and a brain in here. As you correctly said to your tutor all those years ago, that interaction would not actually produce a conscious world. But it's also not a reduction to a finite mind making its field of perception for itself. All I'm saying is that if we step back from the mechanistic picture of nature and try to see how it is that mind is so marvelously open to the world and the world to mind and the relation that exists between them, perhaps we should invert the modern perspective, which has for three centuries and more been trying to explain how this kind of consciousness could emerge from purely mechanical actions, and instead ask whether the ancient supposition was more correct, that the sort of world we inhabit and in which consciousness is not an anomaly but actually a revelation of the deep structure of being, whether that world is itself consists in a series of thought-like rational relations. I think often, let's not forget how badly the early modern period misconstrued, or at least how violently it rewrote the history of ancient thought. When we talk about, say, we'll just take the obvious example, the Aristotelian fourfold of causality, we inevitably hear that as a system of extrinsic physical forces acting upon one another, right? But of course, that's not what atia are. They're really just a series. Rather, it's a description of rational relations inhering in any object of consciousness, any substance within the whole of reality. And in that, you know, that picture, we begin to think, well, maybe actually the pre-modern perspective wasn't absurd in presuming that nature and mind are not two extrinsic realities that have to be reconciled, but rather that nature is itself already explicable in terms that are mental, that the notion that we understand nature best by entirely evacuating it of the mental was a methodological fiction that at the end, in order to arrive at true intelligibility, will ultimately have to be abandoned as a metaphysics.
I'm just about keeping up, but Raymond, do you want to?
Yes, I mean,
it's fine. It is. For you, it's early in the morning. For me, I should be more than capable in the afternoon of understanding this. But anyway,
David, I think we're Raymond. Totally at one with dancing on the grave of early modern sort of mechanical accounts of the universe. So in a sense, we can park those up. I think we're probably at one with dancing on the grave of transcendental idealism a la Kant. The question is, does that then deliver us what I think you want, which is the notion of some kind of theistic or whatever support for our understanding of the world, that in a sense the logos of the world is reflected in our minds, the logos of God is reflected in our minds. The things we agree about, I don't think, deliver the positive vision that you have. That's why I'm, in a sense, an ontological agnostic. I don't think I can make that extra jump.
Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, and as I say, we're not going to hammer this out within an hour. It would take at least an hour and 4 minutes.
But, or indeed eternity.
Or that, one or the other. If I were to stake out my ground, I'd say that two things. The first is that the thinking about consciousness has to be also placed, has to be juxtaposed with certain questions about ontology, certain questions, other sorts of questions. The Experience of God, the book that that Justin mentioned at the beginning, only treats of consciousness in one chapter. The project I'm engaged in now is a large book on philosophy of mind, I admit, in which I'll be focusing just on that. But the other is that even within terms of a coherent phenomenology of the conscious act, I do think that ultimately your explanations will fall apart if they don't presuppose that the finite act of consciousness presupposes, even requires, and by infinite, understand what I mean, is absolutely simple coincidence of knower and known in a transcendent source. But the problem is, again, when we talk about theistic explanations, we wander into all sorts of lexicographical ambiguities, because in this country, for instance, if you say a theistic explanation of how mind and nature or how mind and being coincide, you're likely to get some kind of intelligent design theory or something which starts from an essential dualism and then explains it away in terms of a very clever cosmic mechanic who simply whose own act of intelligent design is then to produce smaller minds that can do what he does. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the very act of consciousness itself, in its depths, and again, it's a long argument, is ultimately inexplicable in terms simply of finite acts of cognition, will, desire
Well, it's perfectly obvious. Yeah, clearly, consciousness wouldn't be explained by parts of itself, by finite acts. That I accept. What I find difficult is the jump from your acknowledging that finite acts of consciousness cannot be explained mechanistically or indeed in relation to some kind of model that Kant offered, but how you then jump from those things on which we are both agreed to a very bold claim, which actually seems to me to fall victim to precisely the problems that transcendental idealism falls victim to, which is trying to explain individual viewpoints, individual moral agents, bits of knowledge, the gradual acquisition of knowledge, etc., all of those things which are part of the phenomenology of our consciousness and our knowledge. It's the jump that I can't make. Now, you say there are long arguments.
I don't actually see what the disjunction there is. To me, when you retreat to precisely the transcendental conditions, I'm not using that in the Kantian sense entirely, but it's a handy catch-all phrase, the transcendental conditions of consciousness, and you just take, for instance, intentionality and the way in which the mind is related to being by a sort of tacit or implicit foregrasp of the entirety of being as an intelligible whole, this will towards of the mind to know all things and to presume a perfect intelligibility of all things, and at the same time understand that this proceeds out of and returns to.
David, can I just clarify here? Can I just clarify what you're saying is not that we have either aspiration to or indeed a grasp of the intelligibility of all things, but there is something that does, or not necessarily something, there is a, well, perhaps something that does, that, as it were, then underpins our individual acts of consciousness, our individual piece of knowledge, and so on. I'm very unclear.
I would say that every act of consciousness occurs within between these transcendental poles, neither of which fits into a picture of nature.
Now, for that, I would require
either of which is clearly, by definition, well, I would say infinite in the sense of simple, non-composite, non-distinct, non-dual.
That looks like an assertion we're, rather than something that's either argued
Can I move us along a bit? Because obviously...
It is an assertion within the context of a radio conversation. It is, however, a well-worked-out argument within many different philosophical traditions. I would in fact recommend, for instance, even though I have problems with certain aspects of it, looking at Bernard Lonergan's arguments in Insight for how the mind's act of intelligence and intelligibility ultimately leads to a necessary theological supposition.
I will admit that within the context of this conversation,
we are inevitably having to take shortcuts. Obviously, you two need to get together in a pub and duke this out all evening. At
now
some
it gets
point.
Interesting.
Look, let me just draw us back to perhaps ground where we can all start to sort of look at something a little bit simpler. Though I imagine it'll get complex. The word that you use to title your book, logos, is familiar to many Christians as obviously the Greek word that is used in the Gospel of John to begin that, you know, grand poem of the coming of Jesus into the world. In the beginning was the word, the logos. The word was with God and was God, and so on. What do you mean by logos? How does that play into this idea of us making sense of the world, Raymond?
I mean, it is... Basically, logos is a lexical thicket. You can follow all sorts of branches of the meaning, and it can have very large meanings, the intelligibility of the world. It can have narrow meanings, such as the property of certain arguments, and so on and so forth. So it's a word that has got a huge history. To me, actually, it is that in virtue of which the world is a given, or, if you like, that being is given. Mm. It is the thatness of the world. There's one particular neologism that I introduce in the book, which is Vata. And it seems to me Vata is at least as important as matter in our world picture, in the world we live in. And I don't mean that in a transcendental idealist sense. I mean it is in the sense of that the most extraordinary fact is that we live within lots of that X is the case, that is the case, that such and such is the case. We live in a world of facts and so on. So that's what logos is for me. More broadly, it is the intelligibility of the world. It's a word that has a huge history that begins with the pre-Socratic philosophers, most notably Heraclitus, for whom logos was not only the intelligibility of the world, but its reflection in the intelligent mind of the philosopher, and sometimes in the intelligent mind of the people.
I've often heard it sort of defined in the Christian sense that it's often used in John's Gospel as sort of the logos being the sort of creative principle of order or something that brought everything into existence, as it were.
Well, very much, and I mean, there is a very interesting, as it were, genealogy that passes through Philo of Alexander to basically Christian thought. I mean, I think those first 14 verses of St. John are absolutely thrilling, even for an atheist, because they do actually bring you face to face with the astonishing fact that the world makes some kind of sense.
You've actually translated the New Testament, David. That was one of your most recent projects. I know that you've had a little disagreement with another person who's a regular on this show, N.T. Wright, over it, but how do you?
I've never heard of the gentleman.
But
if he is a gentleman,
well, let's not go there. But I was wondering if you can, just off the top of your head, recall how do you choose to translate those first verses of John chapter 1 yourself?
Yeah, no, I don't translate the word logos at all. My translation of enarche, you know, logos is just. In the beginning, or actually in the origin, at the origin, there was the logos, and I then have a whole fretwork of critical apparatus explaining the various different connotations of the word, both in Hellenistic Jewish and ancient Greek philosophy, and the way it was used in the early first century, precisely because it is a word that carries far too great a range of meanings to be reduced
to just one of them. Yes, and in that sense, so you leave it as it is. But if you could attempt at least to kind of give some kind of an idea of how in the Christian framework logos is generally seen to be, if you like, an explanation of well, what is it exactly? What is trying to be expressed in that beautiful poetry?
Well, a great number of things, you see. That's the problem, is that seems like a simple question. One, yes, is that the divine principle of this world is a principle of rationality, intelligibility, utterability, of course, because logos also has the meaning of word, though not the limited sense of rima or other of a simple finite utterance in that context. But Raymond mentioned Philo of Alexandria, of course, in Hellenistic Judaism and in Christian thought that was dependent thereon. The way in which, and in fact, in the whole late antique model of reality, there was a kind of mediating principle between the mystery of God and the intelligibility and beauty and order of this world, and this is called logos. And of course, in later Christian thought develops, this logos, who is the Son, is also understood as an eternal co-equal principle in the nature of God Himself, and so on. So, I don't mean to ramble on. It's just
no, it's helpful though.
Raymond is on to something. Correct. I mean, he understands better than most Christians who are limited just to traditional English renderings of the book, and therefore maybe not aware of the metaphysical vastitudes contained in that word, that an assertion is being made in those verses about the relation between this world and God in terms of intelligibility, order, structure, the correspondence between being and mind that reaches very deep into the most essential questions of Christian and Jewish and pagan thought.
Raymond.
One of the things, David, I found very poignant is the word becoming flesh. I mean, that is such, to me, as a human being, that is a deeply humanistic thought. And it's interesting, I've tried to connect it in the book with a sentence towards the end of Augustine's City of God, when he said that God created man, that there shall be a beginning in the world. And the notion that in the beginning was the word, I sort of argue perhaps what was meant was in the beginning was the word beginning, that when the word was uttered, so there was a beginning. Rather complicated and rambling and probably not theologically sound, but that to me represented a deeply poignant sentiment that runs through the religion of the Logos, through Christianity.
But of course, when you put it that way, it raises the oldest philosophical issue in a sense, but the one that's often, again, more implicit than explicit, which is simply whether or not there's ultimately a convertibility between what we mean by being and what we mean by knowing, whether existence is by definition an act of knowledge. And I think, in a sense, you know, well, when, for instance, someone like Eugene Wigner years ago tried to take the Copenhagen understanding of quantum mechanics as a proof of the reality of consciousness, because consciousness is required to induce, at that time, what was assumed to be an unarguable aspect of quantum mechanics, the collapse of the wave function. He was, you know, the question he raised was sort of clumsy in some ways and interesting in others. But what it did, it harkened back to the issue of the degree to which, unless there is mind knowing an articulated reality of things in order, that you know, if there, if a tree falls in a forest and there's no one there to hear it, is there a sound? That's actually a much deeper question than we often give it credit for being.
It most certainly is, and it's interesting you mentioned Wigner, because Wigner, in his fantastic essay, which is the basically inexplicable power of science,
the extraordinary effectiveness of mathematics or something
in physics, and he points out that actually it isn't extraordinary, because within physics you have the laws, but what is missing from physics are initial conditions, the beginning.
Right.
In the beginning, there was no physics, or at least the physics doesn't have beginnings. And actually, coming back to the relationship between knowing and being, one of the interpretations, I guess, of the Genesis myth, which is light comes first, is that stuff and sense co-emerged, that these are the two things that came together. My own feelings, I still resile from that, because they're making sense of the world is such a small part of the world of which we make sense. For you, it's different. I know you feel there is already made sense. There's already an intelligibility.
But how is it small? How is it a small thing? Because you're starting from this, you know, the great expanse of the universe, and within it, a small, feeble light of consciousness making sense of it. But for me, it's just the opposite. It's that the universe that exists as a local phenomenon within consciousness. I see. It's funny that for me, the issue is quite the opposite. Is how something as friable and frangible and reducible to phenomenal impressions can coherently be grasp by how it could exist within the vast logical capacities of mind, and yet it does so again and again. Nature does answer to such things as mathematics, to the acts of rational consciousness.
I'm not sure what nature does. The nature is a system of magnitudes. Is nature drained of pretty well everything?
Right. Well, I'm not using nature in the modern sense when I use that word. I just mean the order of things that are, not just by mathematics, but by phenomenal and intentional and moral consciousness. I didn't mean to suggest only mathematics.
Let's go to a quick break, gents. We're in a highly philosophical and fascinating edition of Unbelievable today. It's all, as I say, if you want to get sort of more on this from both the positions that are represented today, two great books to start with would be Logos, The Mystery of How We Make Sense of the World. Raymond Tallis is my guest in studio. And David Bentley Hart's The Experience of God, Being, Consciousness and Bliss is also a good place to go if you want to get an idea on David's positions on these matters. We're only going to have a short moment, a few minutes to start wrapping things up in our final section today, gentlemen, but it's been a really great conversation today. Do join us again on the other side of a very short break. You're listening to Unbelievable.
If you listen to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio and enjoy the conversations between Christians and skeptics, then this is the perfect app for you. For the latest updates, podcasts, videos, articles, bonus content and much more, download the Premier Unbelievable app today.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, bringing you a very in-depth philosophical debate today. We'll be returning to David Bentley Hart and Raymond Tallis shortly. Always try to bring you interesting guests, different topics every week. Last week it was astronomy. The week before that, we had John Haidt and Andrew Wilson debating the snowflake generation. I think it was gender and the church at the beginning of the year with my guests Phil Moore and Natalie Collins. So we'll be bringing you some of the feedback to recent editions of the show towards the end of today's programme. Also airing this last week on Premier Christian Radio and via video was my full interview with Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, covering issues like prayer, evangelism, speaking in tongues. We talked about politics, Brexit, LGBT issues, church unity. We covered a lot actually in about half an hour. So if you want to watch that in full, it's available now at premier.org.uk/Justin Welby. We've called the page When Justin Met Justin. So again, premier.org.uk/Justin Welby to watch that interview in full. And I will post it up to the Unbelievable podcast feed as well in due course for anyone who wants to catch it via the podcast as a convenient way of listening back to the audio. Next week on Unbelievable, it's John Lennox versus Peter Atkins. That'll be our radio show and podcast. But if you'd like to watch it happening live, it will be broadcast from Southampton University. I'll be sitting down with the Christian and atheist professor as we debate, can science explain everything, in front of a student audience there. You can, though, the general public can get along to a live screening of it at Highfield Church in Southampton, or you can watch it wherever you are from the comfort of your own home via the Unbelievable YouTube channel. So just make sure you're there and ready to watch on Thursday, the 31st of January at 7:30 p.m. UK time. You can find the link to the Unbelievable YouTube channel from the Unbelievable show page, or simply go to youtube.com/PremierUnbelievable. Make sure you're there. Should be a really interesting evening as I bring those two well-known participants together for next week's show. If you can stick around after Unbelievable today, Peter Luce is Sam Hale's guest on The Profile. He's Managing Director of Integrity Music, going to be talking about life in the Christian music industry. And as ever, you can get The Profile on its own podcast as well.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We've had a really interesting discussion on the Logos, consciousness, being, getting quite, you know, philosophical and in-depth, really. And it's made me want to go and do a lot more reading in the area myself, as we've been joined on Unbelievable today by Raymond Tallis and also David Bentley Hart. We often come to this point at some point in some of the discussions we have on this programme, Raymond, where we sort of, everyone's in agreement that the universe is an incredible place, that the how we came to understand.
I think
anywhere else.
I was going to say, Carlyle would say, "Gad, you'd better." Yeah.
but also this sense of why things are the way they are, why we have been granted the ability to understand the vast expanses of this universe to some degree, with just these, you know, few pounds of grey matter that we all have on top of our spinal cords. In fact, just on last week's programme, that was being remarked upon by, I don't know if you know him, Dr. Alan Chapman, who's an Oxford historian and astronomer, who's just brought out a fascinating book. We were talking about it with Lord Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, last week on the show, on the history of scientific inquiry and so on. And for Dave, for Dr. Alan Chapman, who's a Christian, he sees that as he puts it, congruent, the way that faith kind of tends to make sense in his view of our ability to explore the recesses of the universe and physics and astronomy and everything else. That there's an order behind the order we witness sort of makes sense. For Martin Rees, he felt like, rather like you, I think, well, that's an unnecessary leap. I'm agnostic as to why there is this apparent order in the universe and this kind of... And so, I don't know, does it all depend on our presuppositions, what we go into this with, as to whether we're willing to see a mind behind the minds that we do understand, you know, that we all agree we have in that sense?
I think the problem is if we explain our partial understanding of the world by some kind of benign intelligence, which is either reflected in us or supported in us, then we have the problem of all the effort and struggle we have to understand bits of the world. We don't understand the evolution of knowledge. It sounds as if it's all done and dusted at the beginning, that in the beginning there was light and job done. Well, in the beginning there was sort of twilight and dust and so on and so forth. And in the beginning was half-light is a difficult problem for us to understand. I think it's the growth and progress of knowledge that is the particular challenge. And indeed, that progress doesn't have any obvious terminus. Nonetheless, we mustn't be too, although I mentioned our little brains and our little bonces, our pinprick bonces, we mustn't, as it were, focus too much on that, because, of course, this is a collaborative enterprise. And already David's mentioned intentionality, and one of the extraordinary features of human beings is shared or joined or collective intentionality. And when I'm involved in science, as I was for 30 years, I've actually inherited all the thoughtful activity of hundreds of thousands of people over many hundreds of years. So it's not all down to the individual pinprick bonds trying to twig what's going on in the universe. It's very important to think of that. And that's one of our extraordinary features as human beings. That's one of the great distances we have, even from our nearest primate kin.
Mm. I mean, at the risk of this sounding like a very morbid question, when you die, Raymond, do you believe that your consciousness sort of just ceases to be? Does what you believe about the mysterious nature of consciousness give you any rise to think that there might be some kind of continuation in any sense beyond
death? Not at all. I think my brain is a necessary condition of my consciousness, but what happens in the brain isn't the sum total of my consciousness.
Right.
Or that it isn't, as it were, a sufficient explanation of my consciousness. But chop my head off, my IQ falls. End of story.
Yeah. David, where do you want to come in on some of the things that we've just been talking as we start to wrap up today's show?
Well, one's IQ does tend to fall when one's head is chopped off, unless you happen to be president of the United States at the moment.
But that's starting from a low baseline.
It doesn't seem necessary to me actually to argue over anything here. I will say this, the thought that the eternal reality of things is complete, and therefore whatever the eternal truth of things also knows itself as truth, in no way detracts from the drama, the splendor, the agony of a finite spirit coming into being by way of, among other things, the search for truth and beauty and goodness. I don't have the same disquiet about the reality that God already knows, because I don't think of him as a knowing subject in the way that I am, as not as a finite agent somewhere knowing reality as an object of cognition or speculation beyond himself. So I simply see that knowledge, that ultimate coincidence between knower and known, between being and intention, as being grounded in a divine source, an end that I think, and again, impossible to argue here, is a logically inevitable conclusion of reason. Why I think ultimately all good philosophy ends up gravitating in a sort of Plotinian or Vedantic direction as soon as it begins seriously contemplating the relationship between consciousness and being.
David, could I just ask
that
you?
That said, I don't want to presume to know. I mean, I'm not talking about it. Oh, sorry, you were going to ask me something.
I'm just going to ask you whether the concept of knowledge survives translation from knowing individuals as like you and me and Justin. Does the concept of knowledge survive, as it were, translated to an infinite being?
I don't believe in an infinite being in the sense of a discrete being, but yes. No, that's all right. I understand, you know. Yeah, analogically, because the conditions that make knowledge possible start and end from that coincidence of intelligence and intelligibility, but only analogically. I'm not claiming that I have an intuition of or a picture of that I could understand with my finite mind, but all such claims are claims that are analogous. I mean, what is it that you do when you try to know? Ideally, what you're hoping is that your act of intelligence and the reality of the intelligibility of being coincide to a degree where there's, you know, nihil inter sit, let there be no distinction between them. Now, that's an impossible ideal, perhaps, for a finite being, and yet it is the intentional horizon of every act of finite cognition. That being so, I mean, I don't have to pretend that I could, in a flash of inspiration, know what it's like to be God, but I can see analogously how we can talk of love and knowledge and God while admitting that our language is infinitely inadequate. The question I have for you is whether, ultimately, when you look at the structure of knowledge, you can make sense of it, finally, without that presupposition of an infinite coincidence.
I can't understand knowledge, and I know right. that I don't understand
well,
knowledge.
I mean,
but hang on a sec. I mean, it seems to me that there are characteristics of knowledge that don't survive translation to some putative infinite or whatever being. First of all, knowledge is related to a viewpoint. Secondly, the object of knowledge, by definition, is other than the experience of knowing. Otherwise, the object would not have, as it were, an objective reality. There has to be something left opaque in the object of knowledge for it to be a genuinely other than myself as a subject. So that kind of distance...
I agree with that, but other than myself is not the same as saying other in its ultimate nature from the knowledge that God has of it. And I don't agree that something has to remain opaque. I think that that's, again, a sort of dualist superstition, one that one, again, finds beautifully expressed in Kant as in the first, you know, true critical project in modern thought, in modern Western thought at least. But I admit for finite beings, it's a relation of subject and object. My claim is the ancient idealist one, common to European and Indian and other forms of thought, that duality itself is intelligible only in terms ultimately of an undifferentiated simplicity.
Just to bring it back to something that I'm at least somewhat familiar with, I don't claim to know all of the philosophers and points of view that you guys have been discussing, though it's been fascinating. But I know that St. Paul used words like, now we see in a glass darkly, but then we shall know and be fully known. And he quoted the philosophers of the time saying, in him we live and move and have our being. And some of what you've been saying sounds like, David, that's what's being expressed at some level by Paul in his writing, that there is this sense in which we exist to know and to be known by, and that God is not an external object kind of outside of ourselves in that sense, but is the substance in which we move and live and have our being, that we can be conscious because of this ultimate grounding. Is that the way you would sort of see Paul going in those kinds of passages?
Yeah. Oh, yes, very much. I mean, I think Paul and elsewhere in his own writings, you see, he's very much a Hellenistic Jewish thinker of his time and is aware of the metaphysical ambiguities, but also the metaphysical range of what he's saying. And precisely.
Well, I'm glad
or imprecisely.
I'm glad I managed to understand at least one element of today's program. But no, seriously, it's been really fascinating having you both on to discuss and debate these important issues. As I say, even with an hour, we've not had enough time to really dig in and to be able to pursue all the different rabbit trails we could have. You will just have to settle for reading the books. Logos, The Mystery of How We Make Sense of the World, is available now from Raymond Tallis. And of course, The Experience of God is also available from David Bentley Hart. I'll make sure there are links to from today's show. Now, before we came on air, you also wanted to mention another book and collective that's been of great interest recently. Richard Norman, the editor of a particular book that you think also plays into some of these discussions and debates, Raymond.
Yes, Religion and Atheism, Bridging the Divide, which seems to me, I found it, I had a chapter in it, but I found the other chapters extremely illuminating for somebody who is not a scorched earth atheist. I am an atheist, but I do believe that it's a funny sort of humanist who doesn't acknowledge the importance of religion, which is such a big part of humanity's history, and that we humanists can learn a lot from religion. Mm. And that I think this book is a genuine attempt to bridge the divide.
Give us the title again of that book.
It's, it's Religion and Atheism, Bridging the Divide.
Yes.
I hope I got that right. And it's Anthony Carroll and Richard Norman are the editors. Richard is Anthony Carroll has religious beliefs and Richard doesn't. So the two editors themselves
I think it brings together different points of view from both sides debate.
Yeah.
In fact, if memory serves, actually, David, last time you were on the show, it was with Richard Norman debating some of these sorts of issues. But
it was, yes.
Yeah, well, fantastic. I'll make sure there are links to that as well as both your books.
In fact, the opening chapter is a dialogue I have with a fellow person who's interested in the Orthodox Church, is Rowan Williams. David, I know you're an Orthodox Christian, but he himself cut his teeth, as it were, on Dostoevsky in the Orthodox Church.
On Vladimir Lossky. Yeah, I know, exactly. I know Rowan. So.
Well, there you go.
There you go. There's a lot of shared interests. And yes, well, I think as much as you do disagree, I think you've both enjoyed engaging with each other today from what I can tell.
Very much so. I think we agreed about enough to make our disagreements interesting.
Exactly. That's often the disagreements are most interesting is when you actually have some common ground to begin with. So thank you very much both for being on the show today. If you want to listen again, do go to the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and you'll find alongside today's show there links to both my guests. But for the moment, Raymond and David, thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you for having
us. Thank you.
Thanks. Nice to meet you, David.
Good to meet you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Let me know what you thought. unbelievable@premier.org.uk for the email address, or you can leave a comment in the comment section underneath today's show at the webpage premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And there, of course, you can find more links to my guests, their books, and indeed where you can get hold of the podcast and other ways to get in touch with the show. The Facebook page and the Twitter account are also available for your commentary and to follow the show at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to comment on Facebook. Quick shout out before we get to some of your feedback to say that the next meetup of the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group happens on Monday the 4th of February at 7:30 p.m. Their new venue at the Cock Tavern, Phoenix Road in London, between Euston and King's Cross. This time they're debating abortion, asking should it stay legal. And two regulars from the Unbelievable Discussion Group will be leading that on both sides of that debate. Francis Janosch, who's an atheist, will be proposing the continued legalisation of abortion. And opposite her, Bruce Blackshaw, a Christian from Australia who's recently completed a philosophy degree, now doing a PhD on abortion ethics, is going to be opposing the idea that abortion should stay legal. Of course, it's come into sharp focus just this last week with the passing of that legislation in New York, which I believe allows for abortion up to birth, up to full term in New York now. So that's certainly seen a lot in my social media timeline of people responding to that particular piece of legislation this past week. Thanks to Kathy, who gets in touch from Maryland, says, I've listened to Unbelievable for more than 5 years. Would love to have a US conference on the East Coast of the USA. Always disappointed to hear you're coming, but it's to the West Coast. I'm a homeschool mum. I often have the opportunity to talk about Christ, and your show is so helpful and exciting. Kathy, I'd love to get out to the East Coast at some point. If you, Kathy, or perhaps if you're listening, someone else knows of a church that would be interested in partnering with us to put on something like Unbelievable the Conference on the East Coast, do let me know. Always open to that possibility. We had last week that debate between Dr. Alan Chapman and the Astronomer Royal, Lord Martin Rees, looking at 300 years of astronomical history and faith. And what an interesting conversation it was. Very colourful characters as well, both of them and some of the people they were talking about. And since then, Dr. Alan Chapman, who's just a lovely, lovely chap, has been in touch a few times with his own reflections on the show. Alan says, it was a delight to meet you and be on the show last week. I really enjoyed the whole affair and felt honoured that Martin was willing to come on as well. And you say that you and your wife, Rachel, are taking turns to read my Unbelievable book, thoroughly enjoying it. You say, I've just finished the chapter on Dawkins and memes. Splendid stuff. And you say, like you, I find that the number of grounds that atheists speak on are largely variations on a theme. I always wear a cross in my jacket lapel, and it attracts all sorts of comments and discussion. One BBC TV producer asked me to remove it before going on camera. I refused, saying, if I was wearing a turban and a large bushy beard, would you ask me to have a shave and remove my turban? He flustered apologetically, and the cross remains. I say to clergy friends that I've never had a calling to ordain ministry, but I love being a Christian street fighter, taking on all comers. Well, Alan, you did yourself proud last week. Do check out that show. Fascinating stuff. Really wonderful chat between Alan Chapman and Lord Martin Rees on last week's programme. This one from Joel on the Haidt and Wilson episode, where they were talking about Jonathan Haidt's book, The Coddling of the American Mind and the Righteous Mind, and talking about ethics and Christianity and atheism and evolution and that sort of thing. Just quite a wide-ranging show, but as well as talking about how to bring up children in a kind of robust psychological way. Joel says, great episode, drew a lot of pieces together, very enlightening. It would have been interesting, if nothing else, to have Haidt interact more directly with someone who defends the fragility and hypersensitivity of the young adult American whom Haidt inspects in his books. I say this only because I myself have opportunity to interact with such individuals frequently enough. While it's clear that Haidt writes what he does out of concern for such individuals, my experience has been that they seem to feel attacked when it's observed that it could be unhealthy. Their approach of cocooning themselves off from and attempting to shut or shout down an outside world which may believe or express things differently than they do. Haidt seems gentle and circumspect in his approach to people and topics. Most folks I see who are overtly critical of so-called snowflakes tend to do so in a confrontational and inflammatory manner that makes for a good YouTube video, but probably doesn't advance the dialogue. It might be instructive to see how Haidt himself handles it. Wilson too, I imagine. I guess they would make for a very gentle and persuasive tag team. Thank you, Joel. Good to hear from you. This one from Jeffrey Jones in Hamburg, New York, says that he was interested to hear Frank Viola on last week's episode. You say, interesting guy. Be very interesting to hear him debate an Eastern Orthodox priest or a lay theologian or biblical scholar on the early church, ecclesiology, biblical interpretation, and the Eucharist and sacramentality. Also, are you planning a Roe versus Wade episode? Some pro-life millennials, Christian and non-Christian, are also vegans, and they see opposition to abortion and the rejection of all animal products as part of a single pro-life cause. Please have such a person on, preferably a woman, to debate Richard Carrier on abortion and veganism. The show hasn't had a really good debate for a while now and could use one. Thank you, Jeffrey. Point noted. We'll see what we can do. And Aspen Miller says, I discovered your show about 2 months ago, have been devouring both it and many of the resources from guests on your show since. Such a wonderful production. Top of my list of theology and philosophy resources. Thank you very much, Aspen. You say, I recently grabbed a copy of a new book called Gods of This World, A Philosophical Discussion and Defense of Christian Demonology by Shandon Guthrie, an American with a PhD from Manchester Metropolitan University. Fascinating stuff, discusses demonology in a way I've never heard before. And you'd like to hear a discussion between Dr. Guthrie and either a believer with a different argument for the existence of Satan or state of existence, or a thinker with an argument against the literal existence of Satan. Topic seems desperately to need scholarly attention and demystification to whatever extent possible. And then you quote C.S. Lewis's well-known phrase from the Screwtape Letters. There are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence. The other is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. Okay, thank you very much for that suggestion. Ties in a little with something I've got on my to-do list. I want to bring on Michael Heiser, who's the author of the book The Unseen Realm. And a lot of people saying really should have a discussion on that whole issue of the way he pegs out, if you like, the worldview of the ancient Israelites and Jesus's day in terms of the way they saw the spiritual realities and demonic entities and everything else, and the way he defends it as well from a biblical point of view. So would be interesting to do one on that. It's all going in the big melting pot of ideas. We'll see what can come out in due course. And if you've got suggestions for topics and guests, do, of course, let me know. Always open to more of them. Unbelievable@premier.org.uk to email me. Do check out this week's show on the show page and indeed other editions of the show. Get hold of the app, the newsletter, the DVD, the book and all the other resources that are available from the page there. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. And let me tell you what's coming up next week. Well, it's the big Christian and atheist debate between John Lennox and Peter Atkins as they discuss the question, can science explain everything? That is the title of John Lennox's new book. They'll be meeting at Southampton University this Thursday, the 31st of January at 7:30 p.m. That's a student-only event, but you can join me for it wherever you are in the world via the Unbelievable YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/PremierUnbelievable, and we'll be broadcasting it as next week's show as well. But if you can join me live, why not do that? 7:30 p.m. UK time, Thursday the 31st of January. Hope you can watch along live. Until then, see you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.